Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we got the news yesterday that this year's MacArthur Fellowships, the so-called Genius Awards, included two musicians who we've come to know over the years. One is jazz pianist Vijay Iyer, the other, the classical pianist Jeremy Denk. Now, when you win a MacArthur, it's a bolt out of the blue. You can't apply for it, the process is very secretive, and you don't find out you've even been considered until you get that phone call. Now, I'm guessing Jeremy Denk and Vijay Iyer were slightly less excited to get my phone call, but they were happy enough to recall where they were when they heard from the MacArthurs.
Well, I got the call on the Stairmaster at the gym, so I was drenched in sweat, and I don't know if fate was trying to tell me that I should go to the gym more often.
That's pretty good positive reinforcement for exercise.
It really is, yeah.
How about you, Vijay? Where were you and what was your reaction?
I was standing at the sink opening a can of salmon.
And that's why, in Vijay Iyer's house, a salmon sandwich is now known as a MacArthur. You can hear my full conversation with Vijay and with Jeremy Denk, two of this year's MacArthur Fellows, on our website, soundcheck.org. You can also hear past visits here in the studio by both of them, and you'll hear why they have been recognized as geniuses in their field. We'll also play our conversation as part of tomorrow night's soundcheck, but we wanted to be able to congratulate both of them tonight. Now, in the next hour, we've got Grammy-nominated Americana singer Sarah Jarosz playing live, acclaimed novelist Nicholson Baker talking about his new book and the songs he wrote to go with it. And to begin, having talked about two newly minted geniuses, we speak with the mad scientist behind this music. In 2011, when the Brooklyn dance band LCD Sound System hung up its collective hat, none of us thought that frontman James Murphy would be quiet for long. And in the years since, he's been busy with all kinds of stuff, producing for other bands, running his record label, of course, DFA, creating custom sound systems, and now his latest musical venture is taking him to Broadway, where he's composed music for a new revival of Harold Pinter's Betrayal, starring Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz. The play opens for previews on October 1st. James Murphy joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Good to see you again, James.
Good to see you again as well.
So you are full of surprises. I know you've done some film music, but writing for Broadway.
I like to say I'm writing music for Broadway, which is slightly misleading, because I'm not writing music for a musical, which mm-hmm. would be very funny if I was writing music for Broadway and people were going to sing some weird songs. Which someone actually asked me about recently at doing a public interview, you know, people Q&A thing. Someone's mm-hmm. like, I want to write a musical around your music. And I was like, I don't want you to do that. I don't think that's but nobody needs that.
So Betrayal.
Yes.
So you're not writing for a musical. This is a drama.
This is a drama.
It's kind of three-way love triangle thing. So what role does your music have? What were you asked to do?
Well, the music is not to be a soundtrack in the classic sense, which I think would be really weird. It's supposed to be like just music for transitions, like, mm-hmm. you know, just setting, like going between scenes and between moments, not to ever be a bed underneath action or dialogue. So it's just like part of the transition from scene to scene, from time to time.
So is it acoustic music? Is it your, I mean, I...
It's like composed piano and mostly, yeah, piano and cello.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you compose at the piano?
I do.
And is it all notated and stuff?
It is not. Because the way that I can write, I can read music the way that someone after three classes of English as a second language can speak English. It's really laborious. So what I do is I play things, and I write pieces of music, like two-handed pieces of music, and then I actually hold video camera and video my left hand, mm-hmm. and then I video my right hand, and then I put it down and I record the piece as video. And that way, when I'm sitting there talking to the cellist, is Jeremy Turner. So we'll sit together and we'll break it into, okay, this will be the cello part, this will be the thing, then we'll reverse it. Okay, the cello will do the dominant reverses, and mm-hmm. I'll do the motifs. And we just kind of play together in a room, which is really nice. So we've done work together before. So.
Right. So it's not like, you know, people shouldn't go to this revival of Betrayal by Harold Pinter and expect a little dance party to break out between acts.
No. This is the funny thing for me. It's like because I make music for myself, when I get to make music for a film like Greenberg, or if I get to make music to accompany a play, like, I have a job, and it's really clear to me, and I really enjoy that job, which is, what does this person want to have happen for their piece of work? And it's similar to the job that I would hope somebody would do for me if for a record cover of mine. That I'm going to put myself into it as much as I can, but it's not for me.
Right.
I'm not making music for me. I'm like, Mike Nichols he's a incredibly knowledgeable classical music and opera person.
Mm-hmm. He's the director.
Yeah, he's the
Betrayal.
Director. So I get inspired to make music that fits what his palette is and like what he wants.
As you did with Noah Baumbach's film, Greenberg.
Yeah.
This is music from James Murphy that was done for this film that starred Ben Stiller and Greta Gerwig. A little bit from the soundtrack to the film Greenberg, 2010 film by Noah Baumbach that sported music from my guest James Murphy, both songs and instrumental pieces,
yep.
according to the needs of the film.
Yes, I fielded a lot of questions after that. Like, are you just going to make acoustic music? Because it's a lot of like acoustic guitar and stuff, like really far outside my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, it's like I worked in an Italian restaurant and made pasta.
And so for Betrayal, the play by Harold Pinter that Mike Nichols is directing on Broadway, again, it's what's needed for the transitions in that play.
Yeah.
And what is needed is not something, you know, with four on the floor or
not
electronics.
It would be very weird.
It would be, yeah. So it's piano and cello.
Yeah, and I'm basically having to play essentially like classical piano.
And it'll be on tape during the performances.
Yes, because I can't be there.
That's a bridge too far for
that's
you.
The level of terror, like screwing up somebody else's project is my ultimate nightmare.
Now, so how does this work? I mean, it's your music, but, you know, we have a piano here in the studio, but you cannot just walk over there and start playing the Betrayal music.
I would feel, until it's done... And until, I mean, it's like this is somebody else's reveal. This is somebody else's project. I would feel a little bit like I'm breaching a trust. It's now internal only.
Right.
And then it will be played for people as part of the play.
The play is Betrayal, written by Harold Pinter and directed by Mike Nichols, and starring Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz and Rafe Spall with music by my guest James Murphy of DFA Records and formerly of LCD Sound System. And, you know, people have this idea of the artist as being someone who is responsible only to his or her muse. You're talking about an artist who works collaboratively with and for other people and other projects. And, you know, that's a form of art as well.
It is, but it's a very different one. I'm a horrible collaborator, typically. Like, and I've had to accept that about myself. Like, I am not good at it.
Now, did you tell Arcade Fire that when they came calling and said, will you produce our record?
No, because I came to make their record, which is like, that's my job in the same way that it's my job to do the play. Like, I came to try to get them what they wanted, what they were hoping for, not to try and impose my criteria on them. When I make music as myself, I am very inflexible. And I had to stop being in bands because of that. You know.
So working for someone else, is that kind of liberating?
Incredibly liberating. It depends on who they are, what they want, what their vision is. Like, I do not want to like be at a round table where everybody chimes in and I get emails from different people that are in conflict with the, you know, the main person's vision. I can serve one person really well and I really enjoy it. Because it just takes my... It's like, you know, I'm not the chef anymore. I don't design the... I just have to kill this, you know, this chicken station.
Right. So how was it working with Arcade Fire where, you know, I mean, Wynn Butler is pretty much, you know, seen as the front man, but there are a number of really talented songwriters in that band.
Every member of that band could very easily be the primary creative force of a band. And they do kind of find a way to work together that's I find very admirable, and I'm a little bit jealous of it. they work it out. It's kind of incredible.
Their next album is called Reflector. It's out on October 29th, but the single, the title track, is out already, and we can hear some of the early fruits of James Murphy's labors producing this new song from Arcade Fire. Bit from Arcade Fire's Reflector, the single from the forthcoming album out on October 29th, produced by my guest James Murphy. There's about 15 seconds of this song that has David Bowie doing vocals. How did that happen?
Well, they know him.
But that was probably a file that he sent from his studio.
Not at all.
He showed up and did that?
Yeah, I recorded him. So I met David Bowie.
Wow. And you said...
It's the first time I met David Bowie.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And basically you said to him, I just need you to sing these two lines.
Well, no. I mean, luckily the band was also there and they were, you know, communicating with him. But, I got to record David Bowie, which was an obvious, incredibly large highlight for me.
Mm-hmm. James Murphy with us on Soundcheck. He's written music for Betrayal, which previews on October 1st on Broadway, the Harold Pinter play. Opens on October 27th at the Barrymore Theater on West 47th Street. And since closing up shop with LCD Sound System, you have been doing all of these different things. The last time we spoke, you had some crazy idea about turning the subway turnstiles into a grand musical instrument. You actually have built this sound system.
Yeah.
Is it Despacio?
Despacio.
Despacio. Despacio. Yeah. Tell us what that is and what the idea behind it was.
Well, Despacio is a project of mine with Dave and Steph Diwali, the Soul Wax stroke Too Many DJs fellas stroke Radio Soul Wax guys.
So these are like producers over in the UK.
Producers and DJs, like really good friends of mine, musicians, really good friends of mine that we used to travel together a lot back in the day. And we DJ a lot and we... complain a lot. It's kind of what we do. And we, you know, be like, oh, it's a sound system in this club, blah, 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 blah. And everybody's staring at DJs now and it's boring. And, you know, we just want people to dance and have fun. And you can't play an AC/DC record in a club because it sounds bad. And so we got, you know, complaining. And I always have a project that I want to do. I get really upset about stuff that's not right. Most of my creative drive is like being angry at something and wanting to fix it. But anyway, there was a sound system that I felt was missing. Something that's very natural, the way that like an old Klipshorn would be, a way an old disco system would be, but has the weight and heaviness and power of a modern system, but not as aggressive, more even frequency. Like I wanted something that I wanted a dance club that an opera buff could bring their perfect pressings in, sit in the middle of and listen to their operas and be really happy. And I didn't feel like that existed. So we set about designing quite simply without like rocket sciences and computers, just like literally designing boxes and speakers. And we contacted Macintosh because I own like
that's
old
MC.
MC, yeah. Like not the,
MAC.
Not the jackets.
Right.
Or the Apples.
Or the Apples.
But we contacted them and they loaned us amps, which it's like 50,000 watts of max. So
wow.
It's pretty – but we just wanted to send it. And we did it. We put on records. I put on like Alice Coltrane with Pharoah Sanders, and we put on Philip Glass, and we played the Can. Like we played these things that like don't hold up in modern dance clubs because they're designed around this kind of like hyper-compressed, sample-based music. And because the dynamics – range is so much wider because it's not trying to be limited at the peak painful volume. Instead, it's hovering underneath that volume, and when something happens quite loud, it's got the room to do 140 dB spike that, you know, that shocks you and makes your hair stand up. It was really beautiful, and it's something I'm more proud of this than I should be. I'm really excited about it.
This is an exciting thing, you know, because...
But it's total Ludditism, you know, I mean, in a certain degree. The world is internet is downloading tiny versions of songs designed to be downloaded in tiny versions. And we're, you know, we played, I think Steve Miller, Fly Like an Eagle was one of the hits. Like people, because it sounded massive.
Now, Steve Miller's Fly Like an Eagle played on your Despacio sound system.
Yes.
Is that a different song? Is that a different experience?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It took people a while to stop asking us, what version is this? And we're like, this is the LP. Like, it's not even a 12-inch cut. It's the LP. And, you know.
So now, how did you produce the Arcade Fire? What is that produced for? Is it to be a great record or to sound good?
It's me me waging a war with the world, trying. I mean, it's not entirely up to me. Everybody has their goals. And I also realize that sometimes I'm not the best producer because sometimes I'm like, don't add that part because it's clouding this sonic scape that I've created. And then they'll add the part and then everyone will be like, I love that part. And then like, the song, that's why the song's a hit. Like, so like I've learned that this type of evangelism has to have its limits, and I have to have like a governmental check and balance against myself.
Well, I can't wait to hear what the rest of that record sounds like. And James Murphy's music for Betrayal, the Harold Pinter play in a new production directed by Mike Nichols, opens in previews on October 1st at the Barrymore Theater on West 47th Street. The official opening is October 27th. So, James, a busy month for you coming up. Thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to see you again.
A little bit from James Murphy and his former band, LCD Sound System. The song's called One Touch. Our musical guest in the Soundcheck studio today is Sarah Girose. She's just 22 years old, but she's already a six-year veteran of the music industry. The singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist has performed at the Grand Ole Opry and the Newport Folk Festival. She's played with Punch Brothers and Bela Fleck, has been nominated for a Grammy, and has just released her third album called Build Me Up From Bones. And she's going to play some of it live in the studio. This is Sarah Girose with the title track, Build Me Up From Bones.
Build me up from bones, wrap me up in skin, hold me close enough to breathe me in. The moon's a fingernail, scratching on the back of the night in which we lay beside. Dark and gray, but you've helped me find my way through the wild and wonders of this world. So take me with you now, 'cause I need to show you how I can love you.
That's Sarah Girose and her band playing live in the Soundcheck studio. That's the title track from her third album, the new one called Build Me Up From Bones. Sarah singing, playing the octave mandolin, Alex Hargraves playing fiddle, and Nathaniel Smith playing the cello. We'll talk with Sarah and hear more live music from her in our studio later in the show. But up next, it's writer Nicholson Baker talking about the companion album he recorded for his new novel, Traveling Sprinkler. This is Soundcheck.
Order a pro.
And this will help in a lot of ways.
Give you something tasty.
Give you a pill.
For your frontal lobe.
For your frontal lobe.
I'm your doctor. I'm ready now.
I'm really ready.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Nicholson Baker's new book, Traveling Sprinkler, is about a fairly well-regarded poet named Paul Chowder, who's having a hard time writing a new book, so he picks up a guitar instead and composes a series of songs. And it turns out, so did Nicholson Baker. He joins us here in the studio with his new novel and the actual companion album that he recorded. Nick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Pleased to be here, John. Thank you.
So, Traveling Sprinkler, it's tempting to say it's a sequel to The Anthologist because it's the same character, Paul Chowder.
Sure.
Did it start that way? Was that the intent?
I think it's just, yes, you don't have to read the first book, but of course, it's this guy who has a personality, and I ended up liking him when I finished The Anthologist and thought, and one day was trying to write a nonfiction book, actually, and then ended up thinking, man, I've got to do this in Paul Chowder's voice and have it meander in the way that Paul Chowder would have it meander.
So it started out as nonfiction and then turned into fiction. And at what point did it turn into songs?
It was already becoming songs. I mean, the idea was to try to, what does a middle-aged man have to do to kind of revive or relearn music? How hard is it? And what are these new tools that we have, Logic Pro and other kind of digital editing programs that help us along? What is new about music, and how can we make sounds that are different than I was trying to make back when I was in music school?
So, like Paul Chowder, your fictional character, you too were in music school as a young man.
Yes.
Were you a bassoonist, as he was?
Absolutely. Was a happy bassoonist all through high school, and then graduated early from high school, and then took a year of, I was an applied music major at Eastman School of Music, which just means that you practice the bassoon a lot and play in orchestras and things like that. And I wanted to be a composer.
The book, Traveling Sprinkler, is a dizzying kind of romp through many kinds of music, classical just being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, we're talking about a fictional character, but he does seem to be your alter ego. Now, he's going through a bit of writer's block, and songwriting is his fix. Any parallel to that in your own life?
Writer's block is a useful term that writers use when to imply that they have loads of things to say. And they're just full. And if somebody, some nice person, could just remove the huge stone, their prose would flow. I don't know that that's always true. Mm-hmm. So I think I think. But yes, my writer, my guy Paul, wants to figure out a new way to say it, whatever it is to do. And maybe the best way to say it is to sing it. Mm-hmm. That's what he's trying to figure out.
We're speaking with Nicholson Baker, the author of the new book Traveling Sprinkler, and also the best-selling author of Vox and House of Holes and The Anthologist and others. Let's hear one of the songs that you wrote. Was this during the writing of the book, or were the songs done before this?
Which song is it?
Well, we're going to hear Marry Me, which actually is sort of tied to a kind of pivotal moment in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the earlier songs I wrote, but I came up with a few chords and came up with enough of a layer cake of a loop to then play it. And then I just thought, this time I'm going to write the lyrics in real time. The trouble with doing it like that, if you're not actually good at it, like a rapper is good at it, right?
You know,
freestyle.
Freestyle, right? Yeah.
I can't really freestyle, but I remember trying to come up with rhymes, I think forks rhymed with something, and just saying, the hell with it, just do it. That's why the lyrics are the way they are.
Let's hear Marry Me from my guest, the author, Nicholson Baker.
Maybe you think I'm being premature. I've had trouble with rhyme it up in rhyme. Isn't it time that you and
The writer Nicholson Baker, writer of fiction, of nonfiction, and of songs. A whole bunch of these songs appear in his new novel, Traveling Sprinkler, although there they are the work of Paul Chowder, the poet protagonist. I know you describe the Traveling Sprinkler as this kind of heavy metal lawn thing. Mm-hmm. Be kind to a city boy and tell me exactly what a Traveling Sprinkler is.
Okay, the Traveling Sprinkler, it really looks like a tractor. It's got two big rear wheels and a little front wheel like a tractor. It's shaped like a tractor, but it's kind of heavy. It's made of cast iron. And you screw the hose in the back. The water comes up, spins the twirling element, and that powers the tractor wheel. So it moves forward under the power of its own sprinkler. And you then put the front of the wheel on the hose and it follows the route of the hose. So there's something delightful about it. It's just sort of wandering wherever the hose takes it, right? A nifty little machine.
Mm-hmm. And as Paul, our protagonist, says, it's what America was inventing before it moved on to unmanned drones and the technology of war and such.
Mm-hmm.
So he has very strong political views, as well as very strong and very eclectic musical views. Now, we talked before about, your own love of classical music early on. Do you listen to music when you're writing?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because I thought I'm very grateful to this stuff that's pouring into my ears. When I've written the last four or five books with music thumping away. And it's especially helpful to have kind of inarticulate dance music going as you're trying to write, I think.
So you write about Paul Oakenfold. He's a favorite of Paul Chowder's, that kind of trance music, the electronic dance music, but also Talking Heads and Radiohead and Marvin Gaye. Mm-hmm. And you talk early and often, I say you, Paul Chowder, mm-hmm. talks early and often and obsessively about one of the great preludes by Debussy,
mm-hmm.
The Engulfed Cathedral, or The Sunken Cathedral, mm-hmm. as it's also known.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been a touchstone piece for you?
Yes. When I wanted to be a composer, I had this sort of amazing moment. I put this thing on, Debussy's Preludes. I was in high school. Let the Needle Fall. And I heard this genius figuring things out on the fly, ad hoc solutions to harmonies, and going where he wanted to go, and just saying, the hell with it. I want to go here. No, I'm going to go here. And there were, 12 preludes because of mm-hmm. Chopin's preludes? He was obviously somebody thinking very seriously, getting towards the end of his life, what do I have left to say? And that's what the book is about, too. It's about this poet, not obviously anywhere in the class of Claude Debussy's genius, but he's saying, what do I have left? How can I be a contributor to this, this human enterprise?
Mm-hmm.
He's taking a lot of morphine. He has cancer. He's thinking about sunkenness
mm-hmm.
and about the sinking of his own life, and he's concerned about it. And it's a powerful idea.
I like that interpretation of this piece. Let's hear some of it from Debussy's The Engulfed Cathedral. Just a little bit of Debussy's The Engulfed Cathedral, one of his preludes for piano and touchstone work, both for my guest, Nicholson Baker, and for his fictional alter ego, Paul Chowder, who is the protagonist in Nick's new book called Traveling Sprinkler, a book that is much a meditation on music and politics and tobacco and just the kind of obsessions, the minutiae of our lives that is so important to us. These are big things in, it seems, all of your writing.
Well, you want to talk about love and truth and beauty, right? But it's hard to talk about them as abstract nouns, and you have to get some specifics there. And how do we figure out what the next thing is to think about? And sometimes it's really just that there's a collision of a piece of news that is upsetting or thrilling, or there's somebody that physically bumps into you in a parking lot. So I wanted to do justice to the texture of daily life in a more, I thought, a truer way than most novels do. But I also wanted to really hit some of the high note. What are the greatest things that we have as a country? What can we contribute? It's our musical tradition, really, that is our greatest achievement, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Not our ability to make, you know, hydrogen weapons or anything. And what are some of the things that we should change? What should a single human being who is doing his best, how can he become a better person? And one of the things that my character does, although he is fascinated by music, is he goes to Quaker meeting, where you have to be quiet. You have to sit still among other consenting, silent people and just be quiet for an hour. And that helps him a lot. And it's helped me a lot. I go to Quaker meeting. I'm not a theist. I'm not a God person. But I'm moved. I think there's some sort of spiritual state that happens when you are quiet.
The idea of silence as negative space, not the absence of sound, but a thing into itself. I mean, you know, John Cage was all about this. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's an idea that, you know, is still kind of seeping into at least Western ears, I think.
And the idea that in order to have that kind of transform, that excited, thrilled feeling when an A-flat major chord comes down, that all is predicated on the idea that there's a little period where you're expectantly waiting. And that's a Quaker notion of expectant waiting, waiting for something to happen, waiting to have, being unprepared, being ready to see what you might come to understand if you, without planning for it.
Mm. Are you waiting for the novel to somehow change as a form in the digital age, the way music has been utterly transformed by digital technology? Because it is somewhat startling to be reading along and suddenly see a YouTube link mm-hmm. right there on the page, you know, with its mix of small letters, numerals, and capital letters in weird places. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Boy, it's interesting. That YouTube link, which I thought about it hard. I thought, do I want to do this? Is this too, you know, something too pushy, too avant-garde? I don't know what. I had all kinds of thoughts about the YouTube link. And then I thought, I like these things. I like looking at the kind of gobbledygook of letters, capital, underline, little letters, and it's all with a blue line. And it's just this kind of impenetrable fortress of meaningless stuff. It's like looking at a wall. And you click on it, and instead you flow into something that is actually Stephen Fearing, in this case, playing a song that he plays in a Paris hotel room that somebody happened to catch on film. And that, so what I wanted to do with that was say, okay, YouTube, let's face it, is a huge part of our lives. It's part of a novelist's life. It's part of anybody's life. And let's celebrate it. It's kind of a miracle that we can be joining Stephen Fearing that quickly and out of this kind of jumble of computer letters.
We've been speaking with Nicholson Baker about his new book called Traveling Sprinkler. And actually, we've been speaking a lot about music because there's a lot of music in the book, including this link to the Canadian folk singer Stephen Fearing, which we'll wrap up with. Nick, this has been great fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
That's been a real pleasure. Thanks, John.
I'm waiting for the sky to fall.
Coming up, more live music in our studio from the Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter Sarah Jarosz. This is Soundcheck.
When
I'm John Schaefer. Soundcheck's latest listener challenge is called Remix the Mayor. We've posted audio clips of speeches by various New York City mayors on soundcheck.org, and we want you to make beautiful music with them. In the background, you're hearing an entry that features Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia from the Brooklyn-based band called The New Lines. Thanks to musician Houston Chen of the band The New Lines for that entry. You have just a few more days to submit your entry for Remix the Mayor. For all the details, to get the clips, and to hear the other entries, go to soundcheck.org. Singer-songwriter Sarah Jarosz is in the Soundcheck studio today. We heard her play the title track from her new album Build Me Up From Bones just a little while ago. We'll talk with Sarah about the album in a moment, but first, she and her trio are going to play another piece for us. This song is called Over the Edge, Sarah Jarosz, live on Soundcheck.
Flip the switch and turn the net on. Drop the needle on an old song. Break the ice and pour it my way. Turn the key and light the highway. Thank you.
That is Sarah Jarosz live on Soundcheck with her song called Over the Edge, with Alex Hargraves playing the fiddle and Nathaniel Smith playing the cello and doing some backing vocals. Sarah singing, playing the octave mandolin. Sarah, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us.
It looks like a guitar, at least from a few feet away, until you get up close and see that it's got the double-strung four-course of a mandolin. What's the difference between an octave mandolin and a mandocello?
Well, this octave mandolin, it was built by this guy, Fletcher Brock. And the difference between an octave mandolin and a mandocello is this is just an octave lower than a mandolin.
Right.
So it's G, D, A, E still. And the two G strings and the two D strings are octaves apart as well. So
kinda
that gives
like
it sort
of like a 12-string guitar. Where
yeah,
you have
or like a bazooki, you know.
Okay.
But then a mandocello is C, G, D, A. So it's like a cello would be.
Okay. Because the mandolin family is just like the violin, a family of instruments. You have mandolin, a mandola, a mandocello,
right.
Et cetera.
Exactly.
All right. So the octave mandolin, yet something else, something different yet again. That song has a very old kind of quality to it. I mean, the line about dropping the needle on an old song, you know, it's, I mean, I know this is sort of, you know, people have been talking about this record as having a more mature sound, but were you consciously looking to make something that had that kind of timeless sound to it?
Yeah, I actually wrote that song with my friend Jed Hughes. We did a couple of co-writes for this album. And, you know, I think we were mainly looking to kind of write a song that was fun to play, kind of rock out on. But just the image of, you know, the needle on the old song and kind of a throwback to an older time really kind of intrigued us in the process of writing that.
Have you ever, in fact, dropped a needle on an old song?
I have.
Do you own a record player?
I don't own one, but I've spent time with people who own them, and I have dropped a needle.
This is what we've come to, where a musician can actually go on the air and say, yeah, I've seen people with turntables. I've seen needles and records and all that
kind
of stuff.
I'm saving up for one, though.
So how important was it with this record to get that kind of live performance, you know, the trio in a room together and the tape is rolling?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the biggest difference between this record and my last two, you know. It has the consistency of the fact that I've been working with Gary Pichosa for all three, but I really wanted
to
kind of...
He's the producer.
Yeah, we co-produced all three of my records. And, yeah, you know, the last couple kind of would always start with just me going in and laying down my part and then kind of overdubbing on top of that. And I've been, you know, touring with Alex and Nat for the last 3 years, and I knew that I wanted this sound to kind of be a much bigger part of the record. So, you know, kind of we went in and tracked a lot of it. And then, you know, I also wanted to include some special guests on top of that. So
right. Yeah. So you've got a little electric guitar, a couple of other things happening on the record as well. Now, you mentioned touring with Alex and Nat for the past 3 years, but you've been otherwise occupied for a lot of the past 3 or 4 years at the New England Conservatory of Music. What did you go to NEC to study? I mean, you signed your first record deal at 16. You had a career in the music business already. What did you go there for?
So I went to NEC. I actually first heard about their contemporary improvisation program from my friend Aoife O'Donovan, who played in Crooked Still.
Vocalist, yeah.
And so that's how I heard about it, and it's just a really amazing program. You know, most of the school is a classical conservatory, so people don't really think about the CI program, but it's really gotten a lot of cool recognition over the last several years. And
what does that do for you as a songwriter and performer? You come back to playing with the boys here, and you've got all this Ornette Coleman, Albert Eiler, free jazz stuff in your background all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not necessarily obvious in these songs that would be, you know, that you would call that out as an influence. But, you know, I think it all kind of makes its way in there in a certain sense. And just to be stretched musically and to have my ear kind of stretched so much over the last 4 years, I think was really beneficial. And then kind of on top of all the musical stuff, I got really into poetry in my last year. I got really close to the poetry teacher at NEC, and I think that really helped with the songwriting. And so
Well, the results are there for all to hear on the album Build Me Up From Bones, which is a poetic title. It's out now. It's the third record by Sarah Jarosz, who's here with us and with her trio in the Soundcheck studio. Let's hear another song. This one's called Mile on the Moon. Once again, Sarah Jarosz and her trio live on Soundcheck.
One. Watch me fall. Lose the feeling of it all. I wish the night would let me in. I'm back here knocking on the
It's called Mile on the Moon from Sarah Jarosz and her trio, Sarah singing and playing the octave mandolin. Alex Hargrave switched over to guitar for that song, Nathaniel Smith playing the cello. And that also appears on Sarah's most recent album called Build Me Up From Bones. We were talking before about old songs, Sarah. You do have a couple of, well, older songs on the record.
Mm-hmm.
You've done covers pretty much all, you know, on each of the records. And another Dylan cover, you do this really kind of stripped down, bare bones arrangement of Simple Twist of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other cover is Joanna Newsom, the harpist and singer-songwriter. You do a version of her Book of Right On,
yep,
which is off, I think, her first record.
Milk-Eyed Mender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is she someone who you have kind of followed as a songwriter?
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. Aoife was the first person to tell me about her, but I've been a big fan for a long time, and that song in particular is just one of my favorites. So it's a fun one to play.
Yeah. Well, the new album is called Build Me Up From Bones, and Sarah, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Sarah Giroux on Soundcheck.
We should shine a light on, and the book I've read on's read on, it was read on. I killed my dinner with karate, kick 'em in the face, taste the body shallow. Work is the work that I do. And do you wanna sit at my table, my fight and fame is fable, and fortune finds me fit and able.
Tomorrow on Soundcheck, radio and television host Eddie Trunk recently released the second volume of his Essential Hard Rock and Heavy Metal series. He joins us to discuss some of his favorite bands. That does it for today's show. See you back here tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.